Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and I'm delighted to be hosting this special series of Emerge Australia podcasts in preparation for Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience and their carers, as well as eminent clinicians working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and associated overlapping conditions. This season is particularly important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign. Designed to ensure the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed. To commence today, I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, never has there been a greater need in my lifetime for the world to celebrate the brotherhood of man globally than now. A world without stigma, a world without discrimination on any grounds, a world where people have equity of access to treatments and medical care. A world where we have biomarkers and diagnostic tests for those with ME and associated conditions, and, dare I dream, a world where we have a cure for these diseases. Against that backdrop, today I'm delighted to introduce to you Dr. Elizabeth Brannigan, Liz, to our podcast. Liz is a passionate educator, researcher and sector leader with over 25 years experience working across the for-purpose sector, higher education and vocational training. Recently, Liz has retired much sooner and more suddenly than anticipated, further to a recent period of serious ill health, meaning she can no longer work, care for her daughter and keep herself upright. At 20 years of age and for the last 4 years, Liz's daughter Scarlett has been sick with long COVID, ME/CFS and POTS, and she's been bedbound for the last two. Liz is an award-winning adult educator and holds a PhD in social anthropology, along with two postgraduate qualifications in education. She's a member of Emerge Australia's Engagement and Fundraising Board Subcommittee, Principal Fellow of the Higher Education Academy, and a founding board member of the Luke Batty Foundation, where she continues to advocate for social justice and community-led change. Welcome to our podcast today, Liz. It's such a pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Thank you, Anne. It's such a pleasure to be here.
So I always love starting our interviews with a bit of a kickoff that says, tell us a little bit about your personal journey, about yourself, about your personal journey with severe ME/CFS, and how it has impacted your life and your role as an educator and advocate?
Thanks, Anne. That's a great kickoff question. As you mentioned, my daughter Scarlett's been sick for 4 years. She's been bedbound for 2. So the first couple of years she was in high school, she did her VCE largely from home. And that was still, you know, she was able to do that because some of the sort of flexibility around the COVID pandemic was still there in public schools. And so she first got sick with COVID when she was 16, and then she got 2 repeat infections of COVID over the next 2 years. And after the third one, she ended up bedbound. Meanwhile, she had been diagnosed with ME and also with POTS. Oh no, not with POTS at that point, because she managed to get fantastic marks from her bed in VCE because we're in Victoria. And she went off to University of Melbourne, first year science. She wanted to be a biomedical engineer at that point. And she basically just started falling down on campus. So she didn't make it through the first 2 weeks. And that's when we got the third diagnosis for her of POTS. And that's when things started to sort of go rapidly downhill. She'd been reinfected with COVID that Christmas and basically just sort of never got up again. So I have noticed, and I noticed I'm doing it now, that when you ask about me, I always reply about Scarlett. When anybody asks me how I'm doing, what my experience has been, I always talk about Scarlett. And that's because it's just so overwhelming having a person with, you know, very severe ME in the household. So in our household is both myself and her dad, and we have cared for her side by side during this, which has been extraordinary for our relationship in a good way. So we both care for Scarlett, and up until recently, we'd both work 3 days a week. So again, very privileged position to be in, to actually have employers who, you know, would accommodate that. About 2 years ago, I was really in charge of a huge area at La Trobe University. I looked after the learning and teaching unit academy there. I had a staff of nearly 60 people, and I had to resign from working in universities because it was just too demanding and I couldn't give Scarlett the kind of care that I wanted to. And after that, I went happily bounced into not-for-profit land again, where I've worked in the past. But Scarlett became sicker and sicker, and there became this real tension between, you know, jumping on a Zoom call, which was my responsibilities to my employer, and, you know, looking after Scarlett and saying, look, hang on, sweetie, we've just, you know, I've just got to do this for an hour. And so that became, you know, really challenging for me. But it was also challenging for Scarlett because she was like, Mom, I don't want you to quit work. Like, I want you to, you know, have all your interests and have all your experiences outside of this. She'd often say, I don't want both of us to end up, you know, not seeing anyone and not doing anything, which is very generous and kind of her. She's been, you know, such a mature young person about this, but, you know, it just wasn't feasible anymore. So now, you know, this year she's had a little spike on some medication and she's gotten rid of her brain fog. And that's just been a huge thing for someone as intellectual and into, you know, studying as her. So, you know, what we're trying to do is get her back to university one subject at a time, online, through Open Universities Australia. But, you know, a lot of the universities, especially the sandstone universities, don't support online in a meaningful kind of way. So she's a long way off her dream, which is to get back onto the University of Melbourne campus and do her lab work and become a scientist.
Amazing. As you were talking, lots of thoughts went through my mind. You know, how long did it take for you to realize that she had, you know, more than COVID? And how long did the diagnosis take? How did that hit you as the parent?
Yeah, I mean, that was really hard. I mean, it took us, you know, she was in the middle of, I think it was April, we all got COVID. And paradoxically, her dad and I both got really sick, like so sick And she didn't. So she wasn't anywhere near as sick as us. We were lying around in bed and she went back to school and almost immediately caught influenza and really just sort of started going downhill from there. But we probably thought for 6 months, oh, you know, she's just picked this up. She's picked this up. Her immune system's low. She's picking something else up. It's not good. And then she just kept, you know, getting sick with more and more and more things. And actually, we'd tried to take her to the, because she was 16 at the time, we tried to take her to the children's hospital a few times, but she couldn't deal with it. Like, she was like, I need to lie on the floor because you can't lie on the floor. And, you know, there were other, lots of other sick children there. And she was just like, Mom, I can't. So there was multiple sort of, you know, bouncing around. GP, lovely human, has known her since she was born. He didn't have a clue. He does now. He knows all about it now, but he didn't know what was going on. And it was completely coincidental. It was just, I was stressed and I was down getting some acupuncture and I was ranting to my Chinese medicine practitioner about, oh, Scarlett's, you know, been so sick and we think she's got something much worse and we can't, you know, get any help from medical practitioners. And this woman just knew another school mum who was a pediatrician who worked in the children's hospital. And she rang me that night and she said, I'm going to diagnose over the phone, but I have to see her in person. She goes, she's got long COVID. It's a real disease. I will send you the research, because I told her I'm a social science researcher, but I have a PhD, so I can read research. I understand clinical research up to a point. So she sent me all these studies and she goes, you bring Scarlett in, you bring her in lying down in the car, you bring her in, I will have a room ready for her so she can lie down. And she was just like a unicorn. This woman, she was an absolute unicorn, and came in and she said, you've got long COVID and ME. So we were so lucky. It was probably only a year or so before diagnosis. And then the other thing that we did pretty quickly after that was ring and find out about Emerge through Google and ring through and speak to one of the nurses on Emerge call. And she was just so validating about, yes, this is real. And I think for us at that point, we were like, is this real? Like, what is this? Like, we haven't really heard about it. And we just came up to speed so quickly. But yeah, that one unicorn of completely coincidental, you know, meeting that one woman. And she was incredible. And she empowered us with a lot of research to go forward with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what comes through when you're speaking is, A, your persistence to inquire. Mm. Had you not mentioned something to your Chinese medicine doctor, it would have potentially gone in another direction.
Yeah.
And also, I think from what I hear from other people, how important it is, not that you get told what to do, how important validation is to patients and their carers to be made to feel that, yeah, what you're feeling is absolutely real and it's happening and it's a thing. And that often happens before, with some people, it happens before diagnosis.
Yeah.
But made to feel that you're being heard and seen and understood is such a critical issue.
It is such a critical issue. And if I can segue from that to say that there are systemic forces at play in Australia that make that invisibility really hard to overcome. And you can overcome it with a bolshy mother who, you know, reads lots of research and gets in front of things. But, you know, that is in spite of the systems, not because of the system. So I think one of the things, and I find it so interesting and applaud you guys for doing the Count ME campaign that you've come up with, because I've worked in numerous other situations where I have fought professionally for recognition of conditions that have not been named and have not had names and have not been included in data. And I think it's one of the most important things that can happen is actually having something named and counted. It's like, otherwise we're just going back to the beginning all the time. As a parent, I'm constantly in with medical practitioners going, no, it's not just tiredness. No, it's this. No, it affects all the parts of the body. You know, I'm starting from scratch all the time. And I think having it named and counted in, you know, our health systems is just so important.
Yeah, that's what we feel as well. And the counting is critical because, for example, when COVID came along, COVID was reportable. So, you know, our GPs had to report every time one of their patients was diagnosed with COVID. Not so the case for long COVID. And we actually don't have hard data in Australia that would tell us how many people have got long COVID. And that then flows down to really how many people have got ME/CFS as well. Because in a recent interview that I did with Dr. Emma Tippett, who is the principal of Clinic 19, she actually said at our parliamentary friends group meeting that all her long COVID patients have ME.
Yeah.
But unless you count them, you can't tell government what the burden of the disease is.
No.
Because who knows? We have been, Emerge Australia has been working for a good 3.5 years, I think very shortly after I commenced, which is now 5 years ago, I contacted the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare regarding the Australian Burden of Disease study. And we've actually been liaising with them almost ever since.
Mm.
It's been really the last 2 or 3 years that the team have been working with our people who are working in the biomedical research space to set the scene for ME/CFS now to be counted. And that then means that we can much more accurately determine the burden of the disease, and that then helps government, who run our health system, slot in where this disease that affects at least 600,000 to 750,000 people in this country needs to sit systemically as far as health is concerned. So, you know, if it's not counted, you know, you could be saying it doesn't exist, because who knows?
100%. And I think it's not just government too. It's like, even in anecdotal discussions, or in fact with health practitioners, sometimes, you know, we moved a year ago and Scarlett's really lucky that she's got a very POTS aware GP who sort of understands all these things, the new GP, and is, you know, willing to look further. But occasionally we have to go down to the clinic and see someone else. And we've had some nightmare experiences. I had this young guy going, oh, you're a young woman, you're in the prime of your life, just get up. And I'm like, well, she's got an ME diagnosis. He's like, well, who diagnosed that? When was that? Oh, no, you're over that now. Like, no way, you just need to get up. And I was like, oh, my God, like throwing statistics at him about, you know, 700,000 people and 75% are young women and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, he wasn't up for it. But I think that the statistics are really important in being able to even argue about it or advocate for it. It's just so, you know, so important. People believe stats much more than they believe lived experience.
Yeah, which is dreadful, really.
Tell me that.
It really is. It is. So going back to lived experience, so Scarlett would be regarded as someone who has severe ME/CFS, bedbound for 2 years.
Yeah.
From your perspective, how does that differ from, you know, other forms of ME/CFS, apart from being bedbound? What kind of symptoms does she have on a daily basis that make her someone that is severe?
Yeah, that's a great question. And she was saying the other day, she said, oh, Mom, if only I could go back and be as sick as I was like 2 years ago. She goes, she goes, it's not much of a dream, you know. She was dreaming of, you know, honours years and going over to study in England, all those things. And now she's like, I just want to be as sick as I was 2 years ago. And that's because 2 years ago when she was moderate, she could still, she still spent a lot of time in bed, but, you know, the fatigue part of it, she was still, she could be very out and about. Now she's hardly ever out of bed. And one of the reasons is fatigue. Another one of the reasons is just full on full body pain. So for a couple of years, she didn't have pain as part of it. And she had specific pains when something was going wrong. But now she's got full body pain all the time. So, you know, even she'll only, you know, be able to wash her hair or something once a week because it's too painful to actually get up and get in the shower. Some of the reasons why she doesn't get dressed is it's too painful. So there's a lot of physical pain. There's a lot of brain fog, which thankfully, I mean, these things, you know, parts of it come and go. She had brain fog for about a year and incredible sort of light sensitivity. So she couldn't read. She couldn't hold a book because she was too weak, and she couldn't read a book because her brain couldn't focus for more than 10 minutes. So very severe brain fog, like just not being able to, she couldn't even watch a film. She could just watch a little 10-minute clip on YouTube. I'd say, come watch a show with me. She couldn't deal with that. She's got a very stomach version of it, which a lot of people do too, but it isn't talked about a lot. So she's constantly got abdominal pain and back pain and, you know, things going on with her bowel and her uterus. That's really big parts of it for her. That's kind of like the bowel and the uterus, you know, problems. She gets horrendous periods, and that's part of it too. And one of the problems that comes with having so many ailments across so many systems is that I've also got the danger of something glorious called polypharmacy, which means that the pills you're taking for one thing can be interacting with the pills you're taking for another part of it. So it's a very much a medical system that looks at things in a disaggregated way, like you go to the gynecologist for your uterus and they want to put you on this.
Absolutely. Look, you've touched on a pet subject of mine for which we have at Emerge Australia absolutely no solution. But one of the things that I raise with our members of parliament, particularly Jed Carney and Tanya Plibersek, is that, and Rebecca White, Assistant Minister Rebecca White, is that there's a lot of money being poured into women's health. But what people tend to overlook is that young women like Scarlett, who has got severe ME/CFS, also has, you know, multiple other problems that relate to women's health issues. So, you can't really deal with women's health in isolation from, we'll not look at the ME/CFS, we'll just look at women's health, because it's a holistic view of a person's condition that is required. And, you know, it may be that someone with severe ME/CFS who's young, who's like Scarlett, that, you know, having a multidisciplinary team approach where you have got a gynecologist involved and you may have other specialties involved working together to make sure that this polypharmacy issue comes up is not harmful to the patient.
Right. And I think it's interesting what you say, which is effectively you can't look at women's health without looking at women.
Yes, we are
whole people with complex bodies. But I think the other thing is, and you know, shout out to Emma Tippett and all the clinicians at Clinic 19, because they're so, so, so brilliant. But if we didn't have services like Clinic 19, which is fully, you know, private, if we didn't have, you know, parents who are giving up their jobs to be the person that tethers all of these specialists together, and we didn't have, you know, specialists we could afford. So I am in a very, we are in a very, very privileged position that we are able to do those things. So I spend a lot of time on the ME groups online, and, you know, I think the majority of people don't have the options that I have. And so, like, all of this is just unachievable for them. And people are doing things, you know, online, that, and they're going, well, you know, have you ever taken ketamine? And I'm like, oh my God, like, this, you know, people are trying to come up with their own solutions. And, you know, that might be valid. Some people have had pain reduction through ketamine in a very clinical setting, but, you know, just kind of deciding to go out and take ketamine as a solution because people can't get access to, you know, the kind of health care they need. And a big one, this is my big one for government, is people can't get to GPs. They can't afford it, but they also can't get there. So bulk bill these people and let them get telehealth. Let them get telehealth, for goodness sake, you know. They cannot get there.
Remove the barriers.
Remove all the barriers.
The barrier that you have to go for one consultation face-to-face before you can access telehealth. I mean,
unbelievable. And you know, I said to my partner before I came on, I said, what do you want, like what things you'd want me to talk about most? And he said time management and appointment management. And it's really real because quite often Scarlett will have an appointment and on the day she is too sick to get there. And so then we have to rebook one appointment and then that cascades out to rebooking all the other appointments because she can't do more than like one a week, especially if she has to leave the house. Even if she has to be in the house, like she can't make a whole lot of them. So this constant kind of juggle of, you know, time management around appointments, and they just can't make it three quarters of the time. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. So you've already talked about, we've already discussed really the impact on your family. So you have retired from work and the issues around time management, etc. Are there any other challenges, big challenges that Scarlett's condition has placed on your family that we haven't discussed?
I think one is, you know, and I know this from anecdotal evidence with my carers group too, because I am in a peer support carers group from Emerge, which has been an absolute godsend. I love those women so much. We're just a bunch of people that get it. But I think one is, you know, I've got another child. Scott's got a brother who lives 3 hours away, and he's not a child, he's a grown adult. But, you know, it's really impacted on our ability to see the rest of our family and, you know, to spend time with family and friends. And most of those people have fallen away, which is, you know, apart from the fact they're awesome, one of the other reason why I love my carers group is, you know, that we don't have a lot of friends and family who've stayed here on this journey. And that's, you know, that's traumatic. And I think that the sort of grief of the loss of the future for Scarlett is huge. Like, she's turning 21 this year and she has got a couple of, you know, aunts who adore her. And they're like, what are we doing for her 21st and what can I buy her? And I'm like, Scarlett doesn't want to celebrate it, guys. I don't know what we're going to do. But, you know, she's in so much grief about, you know, other friends of hers are graduating from uni at this point, you know.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm 21. It's quarter of my life.
Yeah, I mean, you've touched on a point that I've talked about often in our podcast series that's very close to my heart, and that is the issue of grief and loss. There are many people in the ME/CFS community who, as part of their grief and loss, are very angry at what they've lost, which is completely understandable. Mm. But it's really also understanding that, you know, it is the social isolation. It is the fact that, you know, you can't plan to celebrate when you feel that you've lost your life. The other part of it is the confusion that I hear exists around having some form of therapeutic intervention, as in speaking with a therapist. Or there's a lot of negativity around cognitive behavioral therapy, which,
yes,
of course, we don't endorse. But what we do endorse is addressing the grief and calling it out for what it is, because it's really important to understand where all of these emotions, you know, the bad, mad, sad, glad emotional response that you get actually comes from. It actually comes from the loss.
Yeah.
And so some people have ME/CFS in a very supportive environment with family that understand. There are a lot of people that don't have that. And so from there, for them, not having anyone who can discuss that loss with them or at least validate their loss experience can be very challenging as well.
Absolutely. And again, I feel for those people who don't have the resources of family, friends, or, you know, professional support, because again, you have to go to a GP and, you know, sit down and do a mental health plan and so on to actually get access to some of these if you, you know, don't have an income. And
then you've got the issue of the best ones are usually booked out 6 months in advance. Mm. So there are major blockages that patients face, even in the best of circumstances, to get not only their physical needs met when they've got severe ME, but also their emotional well-being.
Mm. And I agree with you too about the, you know, then there's this real tension between, because people often say to me, oh, is it psychological? And I say no. And they say, oh, but is there a psychological element? And I say no. And they're like, doesn't she see a counselor? I'm like, yes, because she's got this horrible disease that she's grieving for. Of course she sees a counselor. I see a counselor. Like, yeah, yes. But it's, you know, people want it to be a psychological disease because it was described as such for so long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind anyway.
Mm.
So, you know, if it's in your mind, well, then you sort of somehow go into this different category.
Which is also wrong, but yeah.
It's very wrong because we now know, I mean, through the work of the guys in Edinburgh, they now have identified 8 areas of the human genome.
Genome, right? Yeah.
ME/CFS that are different to
controls.
So, and that absolutely demonstrates, and we also know from all the research that's been done around the mitochondria, our former medical director used to always talk about the cytokine inflammatory response.
Mm.
Within the body of people with ME/CFS that just keeps going and going and doesn't switch off. So it's like your body doesn't have an off switch. And so there is no doubt that this is not a psychosomatic illness. It's real.
Absolutely.
Real.
And, you know, it's so, I mean, it is interesting, I would hesitate to say good, but it's interesting that long COVID has now shone a spotlight on more of this than, you know, everyone sitting in the dark for the last decade. But I think some of those large data sets that are coming forward now from, you know, the team in Edinburgh and lots of studies in the States and so on, once they can get more of that done, there'll be more traction because, again, you know, people, it's the kind of data that governments and just people on the whole really pay attention to is statistical data and, you know, medical data as well. So, you know, because people went, well, isn't there a scan for it? Isn't there a, you know, can you do DNA testing? Once those things become a routine part of diagnosis, it'll be treated a lot more seriously.
Yeah, exactly. It's getting to what are the biomarkers for what is the diagnostic test, and then, you know, hopefully what is a cure or what are the medications that can relieve some of the symptoms. So, for example, Scarlett's got POTS. Is she on any of the treatments that make a difference to POTS? Because sometimes if you make a difference pharmacologically in one part of the disease, it kind of helps you to cope with some of the other parts.
100%. And yes, she is on the POTS medications, but also, again, shout out to Clinic 19. Just earlier on this year, we were going to take Scarlett off a lot of her medications because she was saying, oh, I feel like a lot of these don't work. And we talked with Clinic 19 about that process. But our Dr. Liz at Clinic 19, who we love, said, why don't we just try this going up on a dose on this famotidine, which is one she was trying. And this is what they do, which is so interesting, which is they use sort of off-label medications that tend to be prescribed for something else, but have usually had some kind of good impact, especially on the inflammation, which is such a huge part of the disease. And she got her onto a much higher dose of a drug called famotidine, which is used for diabetes primarily. And that eradicated her brain fog. And she'd had brain fog for about a year and a half.
And this is where it's really important. And you know, Clinic 19, of course, is a specialist clinic. Mm. Then GPs, they're specialists. And this is where, I guess, the challenges arise for the community in general around ability, having the means to be able to pay for a specialist and also therefore pointing in the direction of government rebates that might ultimately make it easier for those that don't have the financial means to see a specialist to be able to access that kind of care. It's so critical, and that's an area that we're very keen to work, and we are working with Dr. Emma Tippett around how to get around that and put a proposal to government.
I think that's so important. And one of the things that I found to be astonishing and frustrating was the fact that we already knew by the time Scarlett got COVID for the third time that multiple infections were making people much sicker. And can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but the drug that people were getting when they got COVID, if they were in an at-risk cohort.
Paxlovid.
Sorry?
Paxlovid.
Paxlovid was $1,200, right?
Yeah.
And so people I know who were, you know, sort of largely fit and healthy, well, largely healthy, but they got diabetes, they could all get it. And I'm like, Scarlett needs this more than anyone.
Yeah.
But also we were in rural Tasmania on Christmas holidays at that point. It was Christmas Eve and we literally couldn't get it anywhere. But if we'd have got it, I would have got it and I would have paid $1,200, which almost no one has. And, you know, it's kind of like we need these things on the PBS. Like we absolutely need these things on the PBS.
Absolutely been advocating for that. However, it's because of the cost of the drug that it's not on PBS. And they've made the stipulations so narrow, like people over 70, the frailty is one of the categories that we argue against. We say, well, people with ME/CFS fall into that category.
Oh, yeah.
Problem that we know GPs have had in prescribing Paxlovid outside of the rules that have been put in place are that they could get fined and they don't want that. So all of a sudden what comes into play is personal liability for the GP. Follow the rules. And we've certainly tried to advocate very hard. We've put in submissions, so far fallen on deaf ears. But just so you know, and probably now you're in a different space, but they're now saying that metformin, which is a diabetes treatment, is just as effective when you get COVID as Paxlovid. Now, I know that Pfizer wouldn't like me saying that, but the reality is that that is what is being said, and at least metformin is readily available from your GP on a PBS script.
And Scarlett's also on metformin too, but I heard that the other day at the POTS conference, so I was online all day at the POTS conference and shout out to those guys because I thought that it was incredible and I'd expected to drop in and out, but I stayed on all day and I heard that there. And I went to get my COVID booster a couple of days later and I talked to our pharmacist who's brilliant and I said, do you know about this? And she goes, oh, no, I haven't heard that. And then she asks the other two farmers. She goes, oh, that's so interesting. I didn't know. So, again, I don't know if that's like off-label or what, but, you know, the news isn't traveling fast enough.
No, it's not. And only an aware doctor really knows. I know that at one stage my GP told me about metformin. And, you know, I have a strong belief, and this is my personal belief, I'm not saying it as CEO of Emerge Australia, that if you get COVID, the sooner you can kill it or kill the symptoms, as you used to be able to do with the flu, if you had influenza, you could get Tamiflu.
Yeah. And
Tamiflu would stop the symptoms in their tracks.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that you don't get a bit of an after effect a week later, but the minute you can stop the development of those symptoms, you're actually interrupting what your body is wanting to do, and that is keep going and going and going.
Yeah.
So I'm a real believer in Paxlovid, anything that is a treatment that can interrupt the symptoms once you get sick. And we're going to keep advocating for drugs like Paxlovid to be available to more people because
it's an absolute necessity.
So I could keep talking to you for hours, but we are running out of time. I guess I'd like to just touch on a couple of areas. Messages to government from a carer, from a mother whose daughter has severe ME. What specific needs do you see people living with ME/CFS, and what messages would you like to convey to government officials to ensure they meet those needs?
I would repeat myself and say that I think government really needs to step up with, well, the statistics. So a lot of these longitudinal studies are government-funded or government-led, and I think the statistics and the actual measurement is incredibly important. I think in terms of the actual care for people who are sick, the telehealth is critical for this cohort, absolutely critical, and we talked about that already. Removing the requirement for an annual face-to-face with the GP. Scarlett could be still being seen by her wonderful GP who's, you know, in Melbourne, who had so much expertise on her case, and others if we didn't have to fulfil that because we're a two-hour drive away. I would also say, you know, the rural and regional support services for families and carers are abysmal, and we've all moved from Melbourne to regional Victoria during this journey. And yeah, again, it goes back to telehealth, but also, you know, carer support services exist in the bigger metropolises. They really don't exist very much in rural and regional. We have to make that up ourselves. So I think the fact that people are having to come out of, you know, paid employment like myself to, you know, provide care for our people, it means that the carers need some support too. And again, you know, shout out to hugely great support services at Emerge. So I would say, you know, government, look to organisations like Emerge who know their cohort, who have so much evidence of lived experience, and who have, you know, thousands of us who jump up and back something when needed from government, and, you know, fund the kind of programs that Emerge is doing with carer support, with making it online, with peer support, with the, you know, the training I spoke about the importance of the diagnosis and, you know, feeling heard with the support line. The support line is incredible. What those nurses do on such a small fraction of time is phenomenal. So the knowledge is here. Like, just listen to us, listen to Emerge. And yeah, my last one is, this will never happen, but it's like NDIS, get real. Only 10% of this cohort ever fully recover. That constant rebuttal from the NDIS. The support worker down here who I was supposed to have to help us apply told me she wasn't going to work with us because ME wasn't a thing.
Yeah, and that's It's a huge issue that I know we haven't covered, but I can assure you Emerge Australia, A, has put in a submission to the inquiry. B, we are writing tomorrow to actually give evidence at the extension of the inquiry.
Oh, so good.
It's
we all wrote them. There's so many of us with kids, you know, young people, that all of us, you know, who are in your carer support groups and so on, wrote them as well too, because yes, there was an impressive outpouring.
Yeah. Dr. Liz Branigan, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And we're going to have many more discussions, I'm sure. Thank you for your support of Emerge Australia, and thank you for coming on today's podcast. I'm sure that people who will be listening to this podcast will find it of great interest and very helpful to them. So thank you for...
Oh, thank you, Anne, for everything you do. I'm such a huge, huge fan of Emerge, and you're absolutely leading us forward in this space. So it's a pleasure, and I thank you.
So today's podcast is part of the Emerge Australia series, recorded specifically for Severe ME Week in 2026. Our podcasts continue to be a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID and overlapping conditions in Australia. As Emerge Australia concludes a federal government funding cycle and we prepare to seek renewed investment, Emerge Australia is proud to launch the Count ME campaign, a powerful movement to highlight the need for continued momentum and growth in support of patient services, dedicated ME research, clinical education, and health policy change for Australians living with ME/CFS, long COVID and associated energy-limiting conditions. Through Count ME, we will continue to shine a spotlight on groundbreaking developments surrounding these misunderstood and stigmatised conditions and provide critical insights to equip decision makers, ensure appropriate support to effectively meet the needs of our community. Dr. Liz Branigan, thank you so very much for joining me for our podcast today. And to our listeners, tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter or to provide Emerge Australia with your support, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Thank you, Liz, and bye for now.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only